back to Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Now a look at the current state of the civil rights movement in an age of increasing economic, educational, and employment inequality. The conversation about race in America is as important as ever, as is the struggle for equality and justice. But how has the conversation about race changed as the incidences of police brutality across the country are disseminated quickly and widely, or in the context of presidential campaign demagoguery? And how has the movement for civil rights and social justice evolved 60 years after Dr. King led the Montgomery bus boycott? We'll explore this now with the Reverend Todd Eerie. He is the senior pastor of Douglas Memorial Community Church here in Baltimore. He's also an adjunct professor in the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore and the political action chair for the Maryland State Conference of the NAACP. Good morning, and thank you for your time.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Jamie Wooten is the founder of KineticsLive.com. It's an online information ministry. He was a Social Justice Institute Fellow at the Boston University School of Theology. He has organized and documented social movements in the U.S., Africa, and the U.K. He's one of the lead organizers of Baltimore United for Change. He joins us on the phone. Good morning, Jamie. Thank you for your time.
Good morning. Thank you.
Reverend Eerie, it's been close to 9 months since the uprising surrounding the death of Freddie Gray while in police custody. It gave rise to groups like the one that Jamie's so involved in, Baltimore United for Change, the Black Lives Matter movement. When you look back on the things that have happened since April, what do you think the grassroots movement has accomplished so far? What do you think they need to be looking at as we move forward?
Well, I think the grassroots movement has continued to do what movements do, and that's applying pressure to the public discourse to make sure that we don't just move beyond these incidents as episodes, as opposed to understanding them on a continuum of the entrenched nature of racism and ultimately white supremacy. That is the challenge. It was clearly pointed out in the Kerner Commission report. In many ways, it feels like deja vu, but for the fact that the references are different. And so when we look at...
Now remind folks what the Kerner Commission report
was. The Kerner Commission report was President Johnson's convened group to look at the civil disturbances of the 60s after many of his war on poverty initiatives, Great Society plans, because you didn't really see the transformation that they had anticipated when he was putting those policies in place. So you still had urban disturbances in Newark and Detroit and Watts and other places across the country, and it was concerning. So when we look at the issues that were in place then, joblessness, over-policing, bail issues, high bails for low offenses. When you see these themes recurring, what you recognize is that
The Kerner Commission was a long time ago.
It was right after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. Baltimore riot, because it came out in 68 prior to Dr. King's assassination. So here we are almost 50 years later, even though we're looking at the 50-year anniversary of the March on Washington, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, fair housing comes up in 68. We're still not there. And but for grassroots organizations reminding the public conversation that we cannot just kind of move on and think we get a pass, we would be in a far worse situation because we would be easily dismissing what's going on.
Jamie Wooten, your organization, Baltimore United for Change, is a coalition of several groups. Is there a consensus among all of these groups as to tactics, as to particular actions that you're going to want to be taking in these months as, for example, the trials and the officers accused in the death of Freddie Gray unfold?
Many of us, you know, we came together and formed 3 days after the death of Freddie Gray, but many of us have worked together throughout the years, and so we'll continue the work that we've always done. Leaders of Beautiful Struggle, Reverend Eva Brown and others will continue the work of lobbying in Annapolis. We'll also host some mayoral debates in the city. I think one of the consensus around the group is sort of what we call nation building, is sort of organizing for power, what we must do for ourselves. And so we look at Reverend Heber Brown and sort of the Food Sovereignty Network, some entrepreneurial projects that we're working on for social impact, really looking at social entrepreneurship and how we begin to sustain our grassroots and community-based organizations to do this work.
The role of the church and how that has evolved since the days of Dr. King. Are there specific structural issues within the African-American church that are either helping or limiting its ability to help coalesce, help motivate and animate movements for social change?
There are always obstacles that are raised to provide a disincentive to organizing people and, more importantly, organizing money. When we look at the resource of the church, it is often the most valuable institution in the Black community, and in many instances, we have been pushed in places where we're forced to kind of change the tactic. So the reluctance of the civil rights era and Dr. King getting folks to get on board with him. Many of his clergy colleagues felt that there was too much at risk for them to get engaged with the bus boycott. Now we know we can't sit on the sideline, but the structural impediments, I believe, in many ways are intentional. There are many studies that are coming out now that in doing community development, the notion of access to capital and how faith institutions are able to participate in the banking process. What we're finding now is that access to capital in 2015 is what redlining was to housing in the middle of the 20th century. And so we've got to recognize that there are formidable issues, but the church is still committed. Although we have to find new ways to engage, grassroots, public engagement, shared investment, those are the tactics that are still required, and we have to recognize that the problem is still very real.
And Jamie Wooten, you've written about the notion of pacifier preachers who are asked to serve as a buffer between the state and African Americans who in their frustration often manifest that or can manifest that in violence. Those same preachers are often not in a position to condemn the violence that the state perpetrates on the African American community.
It was part of a piece that I wrote called Who Has the Right to Be Violent? And it was really a question of moral consistency, that often how the black community, when there are uprisings, are often called violent, and the first ones they go to are our preachers and clergy to condemn that violence. But the same clergy that they sort of neglect when there's violence abroad. And so when I talk about the preacher pacifier, those are the ones who cry peace, peace where there is no peace. And I'm talking about the violence of systemic and structural violence, not just the violence of the police in the state on black bodies, but also the structural violence that exists in Baltimore City. And so the broader question was really more about moral consistency, that the Christian church is not necessarily against violence, right, but it's against certain violence. And who then has the right to be violent when you have a Congress that is 90% white and identifying themselves as Christian, right, who also supports violence abroad or may not condemn state violence? The question was, who has the right then to be violent? And is nonviolent mobilizations around community organizing, is that the only response to state violence?
Yeah, because that's
do the most oppressed have the right to be violent?
But obviously that's a very provocative question, the right to be violent. Does anybody have the right to be violent in any circumstance, Reverend Urey?
I think when we think about the right to be violent, let's change it a little bit. The right to defend one's self-interest by whatever means are appropriate. And so there's this ongoing conversation inside the public discourse around protecting the Second Amendment. Even right now, there's this lingering concern that if I am white and armed, I can take over a federal installation. If I'm black and armed and following the law, I'm going to get rolled up on, right? So we have to recognize that this notion of violence, when it's applied in certain contexts, has been allowed to take on certain meanings. What we want to recognize is the civil rights movement has always been about the right of declaring agency for people who have been excluded from the process. That is the legacy of the United States, even coming into the last year of President Barack Obama, and even more so highlighted because of just the complexity of trying to deal with race representatively, right? So we've got to stay engaged. And if the threat, you know, I require many of my students to read The Art of War, because it is about the use of strategy, that at some point you've got to know how to use the weapons available to you, even though the goal is to avoid using them at all. And if you don't present the threat, if you don't present a very real threat, that is a possibility in the right of one's own self-interest, then you begin to be a pawn in this game of political chess against the best interest of your community.
And Jamie Wooten, bring this back to Dr. King, whose birthday we celebrate today. What is the role of nonviolence then, and the significance of the nonviolent approach to the social justice actions that are taking place in this day and age?
Sure. And let me say that the article was not necessarily promoting violence, right?
Sure.
But just putting out the moral consistency about how we deem certain people violent and others not. I think nonviolence as a tactic, right, it exposes the violence of the nation. So I think it was a very important tactic and role that it played during that movement of King, of looking at the violent nation and using it as a tactic to sort of put a mirror to the face of America.
The historian Taylor Branch has observed that Dr. King always had one foot in the pulpit and another in the street. Reverend Urey, do you think that the black church today is still straddling those two worlds?
I think in all fairness, we have to reset the conversation. All politics being local at its core, I don't think you can assign that critique when the national issues rarely rise to the level of public attention when it comes to issues of race. But when they do, I think you find, as you did in the era of Dr. King, not all, but certainly a representative group of committed faith leaders coming together, trying to move the dial on what we would call progress. And so I think we're facing the same issues internally and externally, but I would argue that the faith of Dr. King started in the church, but informed what happened in the pulpit. And so there has to be this dynamic interplay between the two. The challenge is the rules, if they're not known and they're not consistent, it alters and sometimes paralyzes folks who want to get engaged, they don't know how. So a lot of the work that we do, and Jamie and Dr. Heber Brown are doing a kind of raising awareness and doing teaching along the way to allow folks to make informed decisions about when, where, and how they get engaged in the process.
Mm-hmm. Jamie Wooten, I spoke to Lester Spence, a historian and political scientist at Johns Hopkins. Mm-hmm. He's written a book recently called Knockin' the Hustle, and he actually suggested that perhaps it's time now to leave the prophets, even ones like Dr. King, behind and move into this new era. And you have written that we are in an Ella Baker moment. Ella Baker, of course, instrumental in founding SNCC and the SCLC, which was Dr. King's organization. Some folks have called this a leaderless movement, things like Black Lives Matter. Others have called it a leaderful movement. Mm. What do you think?
Well, I would say leaderful, right, and that there is this movement. So we see, right, this hierarchy normally of media and information and how media now through social media is becoming more decentralized. And we see those tools being used by a new generation that is also decentralizing or democratizing the conversation. And so I think there definitely is this shift from this more patriarchal, messianic, sort of charismatic leadership style to a leaderful type movement. What I write is, I'm putting out a piece tomorrow called MLK the Baker, Beyond Reactivism, Organizing for Power. And I'm saying that if the hashtag can move us to an Ella Baker moment, participatory democracy, that ideology is the glue that holds decentralized organizations together. So right now, we often see, to move us from reactivism of tweeting black death to black death to black death, moving us to holistic community development is what I'm writing and pushing for. I don't think we've defined the movement enough, this sort of decentralized movement, in a way that moves us to really obtaining some concrete goals.
Well, Jamie Wooten, you and Reverend Urey, both very, very provocative, informative, and erudite in your observations. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Thank you very much.
The Reverend Todd Urey is the senior pastor at Douglas Memorial Community Church and adjunct professor in the College of Public Affairs at the University of Baltimore and the political action chair for the Maryland State Conference NAACP. Jamie Wooten is the founder of KineticsLive.com. It's an online information ministry. We've got links to Baltimore United for Change, the KineticsLive.com website, and other social justice resources on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Coming up a little later, a conversation with the director of preservation at Baltimore Heritage about the status of several sites that are significant to the story of African-American history in Baltimore. But first, Jay Wynn Russick is on the way with her weekly theater review. Stay with us.